We are in the third of a series of looking at how the cross changed the world. And there is just no debate, the cross has changed the world. And even if you're not a Christian, the cross has changed the world. The very fact that we in our church display what was once a symbol of Roman oppression and fear that was used to subjugate and terrorise people, and we now see it as a symbol of hope and love, is amazing. The very fact that people in our culture, even who might not necessarily fully understand who Jesus is and what he's done, will wear crosses around their neck is amazing. The fact that most of us, when we've gone into the supermarket for the last few months, and we've walked in at the entry gate, we've been passing mounds of buns with crosses on them. There's just no argument that the death of this one person on a cross, out of all of the hundreds of thousands of people that were crucified by the Roman Empire over centuries, that the death of this one particular person has changed the world. Whatever you might think about who Jesus is and whether he's the Son of God or not, there is just no historical argument about the fact that he and what people remember about happened at that time has changed culture and has changed lives. Now, obviously, as Christians, we think that Jesus is not just another human person, and there's really good reasons that he's a special person, and there's very good reasons why he has changed the world, and we've been looking at some of those. And we have been particularly looking at what Jesus said his cross was all about before it actually happened. There's countless ends of books that have been written, and the New Testament letters also talk about what happened in the first Easter, but we've been specifically looking at what Jesus said happened would happen through the cross. And the first thing we saw that Jesus was going to go to Jerusalem and essentially confront the religious, political and military powers of the day. But he didn't do it with a bigger army or a bigger horse or a bigger sword or a bigger weapon or whatever. He came humbly riding on a donkey, and in the face of their rejection and their capital punishment, he took their suffering, the worst they could do, and rose again. And so the New Testament talks about him disarming the powers. They've done their worst and they found out it wasn't enough. They are defeated. Not yet destroyed, but all of the human powers that would set themselves up against other human beings and up and against this world have been defeated. Just like the COVID vaccine has defeated COVID infections, but it's not yet distributed to everybody. But it has been defeated, but COVID is not yet destroyed. It's not quite the same, but it's a close enough analogy to help us understand it. But it's not just human powers, because when you come up against stuff that happens in this world, sometimes you see, yes, actually there's darker forces, there's hidden forces, there's spiritual forces, there's demonic forces at play. And Jesus also understood that he was judging those forces as well. Then last week we saw that Jesus understood that not only did humans had to be delivered from captivity to spiritual and other forces, they also needed to be forgiven for their sins and saved from the punishment that was coming for those sins. And Jesus established a new covenant in his blood. And that's the way that they used to make covenants back in those days. We don't do it anymore. It would be a bit weird, wouldn't it, if you're signing a contract to buy a house, and what you actually ended up doing was you got a couple of animals, you cut them in half, and then you and the seller walked between them and said, if we don't conclude this deal, this is what's going to happen to us. Well, that's the way they made deals back then. And Jesus basically said, this is what's happening in my, but this is the guarantee. Not only am I able to forgive sins, I will forgive sins. He made this covenant or this agreement with humans for that. And so to help us remember these things, we often use little diagrams in this church, because it's just the visual reminders. And we've got one here, which is the way that the cross works. And we've talked about these two. If you like, Jesus deals with those things outside of us. The Satan and the other powers, he's had a victory over them. But God also deals with our up dimension of our life, between the barrier between us and God, which is our sin, and he deals with that. And there's a third one which we're going to get to today. But before we just move on from this, a word that when you read theology, we've been talking about how Jesus' cross changed the world, but I always want to pause for a moment and talk about why Jesus' cross changed the world and what was the purpose of it. And there's a word that's used in theology that's called atonement, which is a made-up English word that a Bible translator, English Bible translator, made up a few centuries ago. And basically, it's at-one-ment. So what Jesus was doing in the cross, he was enabling us to be at one with or reconciled with God. So when you hear the word atonement, at-one-ment is the best understanding of that. And if we are going to be one with God, then we need to be freed from the powers that would keep us captive and in slavery. And if we are to be one with God, then we also need to have the sin that's between us and God dealt with. And there's another word that's often used in theology, and that's called substitution. And sometimes we can get a bit bamboozled by theological words, but we all know what a substitute is in a sporting sense, right? A substitute goes onto the field to do something for you that you can no longer do for yourself. And so in the cross, Jesus did for us things that we could not do for ourselves. He defeated the evil powers in ways that you and I could not do that. So he was our substitute. He did it on our behalf. He did it for us. And in dealing with our sin with God, he was also our substitute because he took on himself the consequences of that. And there's lots of sometimes unhelpful ways that people are trying to think about that theologically, but you understand that if someone hurts you, or say if someone steals money from you, if you forgive them, you wear the loss. You're saying, you no longer have to pay me back. I'm going to substitute for you. So Jesus' forgiveness is always an act of substitution where you bear the cost of something that the other person should rightfully have done. And however you might try to understand that, some of the unhelpful ways is that the idea is that God, the vindictive Heavenly Father, is whipping Jesus, the Son. No, the Father and the Son together are working together to take within God the things that we couldn't do for ourselves, just be our substitute. But just being freed from external powers and being freed from the barrier between us and God isn't quite enough, is it? Because it's this thing about humanity. And we're seeing it in the news in recent times with all of the terrible things that have been coming to light in Canberra, in Parliament House, and with abuse and other things that have been going on between people, you see. And we have lots of things that people we need to educate people with in our society, don't we? But guess what? There are no classes that you need to take on how to lie or how to steal or how to be a bully in the school playground or how to misuse your power. We don't need lessons for those things. Now, we need ethics lessons for other things like respect and anti-racism and anti-discrimination and all those sorts of things, but there's all these sort of things that we... You know, we just don't teach people. We don't teach our kids to be mean to other kids, right? But they just do it. And that's because the Christian insight is that humans are made in God's image, but we are deformed. It's a bit like we're bowling balls. They'll start off straight, but they're guaranteed to veer off course. And so there's something internal that needs to be dealt with as well. And Jesus knew this because when he was explaining what the cross was about, he also knew that there was this inward dimension that needed to be dealt with. In our first sermon in this series, we looked at how Jesus, it's recorded in Matthew, Mark and Luke three times that he predicted that he was going to Jerusalem to confront the powers, that they would kill him, but that he would rise. He would defeat them. And I'm just going to read the bit from Matthew's Gospel, Matthew chapter 16. from verse 21. From that time on, Jesus began to explain to his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things at the hands of the elders, the chief priests and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and on the third day be raised to life. Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. "Never, Lord," he said. "This shall never happen to you." You see, Peter had just recognized that Jesus was the Messiah, the one that was going to save Israel, and so he just couldn't get his head around the fact that he was going to die and be raised, whatever that meant. And Jesus turned and said to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan. You are a stumbling block to me. You do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns." Then Jesus said to his disciples, "Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me will find it. What good will it be for someone to gain the whole world yet forfeit their soul? Or what can anyone give in exchange for their soul? For the Son of Man is going to come in his Father's glory with his angels, and then he will reward each person according to what they have done. Truly I tell you, some who are standing here will not taste death before they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom." Let's go back to those key verses. Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. That's pretty comprehensive, isn't it? There's no wiggle room there, is there? For whoever wants to save their life will lose it. But whoever loses their life for me will find it. What good will it be for someone to gain the whole world yet forfeit their soul? Or what can anyone give in exchange for their soul? You see, Jesus' diagnosis is not that humans are pretty good and they just need, if they were a house, they just need to be repainted. Or humans are pretty good and they need a bit of repainting and maybe a bit of renovation. No, Jesus says what you actually need is you need a replacement. If you're thinking about it in human body terms, you might think, well, we might say, well, all you really need is you need a bit of makeup. And that doesn't quite do it. Well, what you actually need is you need some plastic surgery. But no, Jesus is saying you actually need a new life. Your old one is a good one, but it is disconnected from God and it is deformed. And you need a new life. And Jesus is saying that somehow in the cross, your old life, your disconnected life, your life that has a bias towards evil and sin is being dealt with. And our job is to participate in that, to take up our cross and follow him, to leave behind your old life. Now, what does that mean? Does that mean like I die and I become a totally different person? No, but let's think about it this way. When you left primary school and went to high school, you left your primary school life behind. When you left school and went to university, you left your school life behind and you embraced a university life. That was a different life. If you get drafted to become a professional sports person, you leave behind your non-sports profession person life, which is people like you and most of you and definitely me who will never be professional at anything, and all of a sudden you have a new life and your new life looks different, doesn't it? Well, maybe if you enlist in the armed services, all of a sudden your life looks different. It's a different life, isn't it? Someone can tell you where to go at the drop of a hat, and then you also might get to jump out of planes and other things. It's a totally different life. And what Jesus is saying is that you need to be willing to leave your old life, not to cease to exist as a person, but to leave that life behind. The life that is going to end anyway. You could spend this earthly life accumulating as much wealth as you like, but guess what? When you die, you take none of it with you. You know, you might spend all of your life trying to look as good and as buff as you possibly could, but guess what? You will get old and you will die. You might like to try and do a lot of things in your strength, but Jesus says, if you try and save this life, if you try and gain this world, you will end up losing it. What we need is not just to be freed from the dark powers, not just to be have out the separation between us and God dealt with, but we also need a new life. And it's not just a redecorating, it's not just a renovation, but it's a replacement. The New Testament uses words like new creation to describe it. Well, how does this happen? Well, in Mark chapter 10, just after Jesus has predicted his death for the third time, and if you have a Bible, it'll probably have a heading that helpfully says, Jesus predicts his death a third time. But then it goes on in verse 35, then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to him. Teacher, they said, we want you to do for us whatever we ask. Bit of chutzpah there. What do you want from me to do for you, he asked. They replied, let one of us sit at your right and the other at your left in your glory. You don't know what you're asking, Jesus said. Can you drink the cup I drink or be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with? We can, they answered. Jesus said, you will drink the cup I drink and be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with. But to sit at my right or left is not for me to grant. These places belong to those for whom they have been prepared. Now, they didn't actually end up being crucified like Jesus was. James was killed in young age by the Jewish authorities or the Romans, I think. I can't remember. It's recorded in early chapters of Acts. And his brother John lived to a very old age, 90 or something. But he spent periods in exile and things like that. But there's these two words here, cup and baptism. And they, for me, refer to the two main Christian sacraments, if you like, of baptism and communion. And when you read in Colossians what Paul described baptism as, he described it as a dying with Christ and being raised to new life. You see, that's what Christians understand is when I become a follower of Jesus, I die to my old life and I become alive to God. God does something in me. And in the early centuries of the Christian faith, often people would be baptized on Easter Sunday. They'd spend months preparing for that. And then they would have a baptism. And they would, not like we do it today, but they, when they were doing the baptism, they would come and they would take off all of their old clothes. They'll be baptized in the nude, which we wouldn't do today. And then they'd come up and they'd be given new clothes and a new name. Powerful outward physical symbols, if you like, that show, yes, I'm leaving my old life. My life independent of God. My life that has biases in it that lead me always to do the wrong thing, ultimately. And I'm coming alive to a new life with God. There's a passage in 1 Corinthians chapter 10 which is not often read in conjunction with communion, because we often read something from 1 Corinthians chapter 11 in conjunction with communion, but Jesus and Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 10 verse 16, is not the cup of thanksgiving for which we give thanks a participation in the blood of Christ? And is not the bread we break our participation in the body of Christ? And so the second thing that Christians do is they share communion, right? And it is our participation in some amazing way in the death and resurrection of Jesus. You know, the passage we started off reading in Matthew 16 is repeated in Mark and Luke, which says, you know, he explained his death and resurrection. He says, if you're going to follow me, you have to deny yourself, take up your cross and follow me. And we might wonder, is there a similar passage in John's Gospel? And there isn't an exactly the similar passage, but there's a passage in chapter 6, verse 53, where Jesus said, "Very truly I tell you, unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you have no life in you. Whoever eats my flesh and drinks my blood has eternal life," not will have in the future after they die when you go to heaven, but has an eternal quality of life, i.e. a life that is a good quality and goes on forever. You have it now, and I will raise them at the last day. You see, a participation in the cross brings new life into us. And so that completes the little triangle diagram. That the cross deals with these three things. It deals with the outward powers that assail us. It deals with our separation from God. And it deals with the disconnection and the bias and the deformity that exists within us. And all of those things are necessary if we are to become one with God, to live the with God life, to live in at-one-ment with God. Jesus said to take up your cross and follow him. He didn't say crucify yourself, because I don't know whether you've ever tried it, but it's really hard to crucify yourself. I mean, you can whack in one arm probably okay, but then how do you do the other one, right? And guess what, again, it's substitution. God does for us what we can't do for ourselves. But as we say, yes, God, I'm willing to give up my old life and receive your new life. I want to participate in the cross. God does for us what we can't do for ourselves. If you come from more liturgical churches, they do things like signing themselves with the sign of the cross, right? And you can read it up on Wikipedia. There's all of these details about what you do. How you hold the fingers, how you hold them together. Do you go from the right to the left or the left to the right? I mean, there's all of this really complex stuff, right? But for me, it's like, am I participating in the cross? You might like, we're not going to become people that do that in this church regularly, but you just might at least like to think about it as a physical way of saying, yeah, I'm participating in what God's done for me through the death and resurrection of Jesus.